Biden could depress the Treasury, move to a parliament, and continue with answers to oral questions. We go to question number 176, and the questioner is the Honourable Dean Jameson.
Can the Minister for Aviation provide further details regarding the aircraft incursions perpetrated by Spanish aircraft in Germany?
Answer the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, our Australian government refers to the incursions of the 28th of January. Two incursions occurred in the Gulf airspace on the 28th of January. The first was by a wider civilian helicopter, resulting in the inbound US flight having to be put into a holding pattern. The second was by a fixed-wing Spanish military aircraft, which delayed the departure of the returning US flight, which had to be held on the ground after it had started taxiing. On neither occasion, the new Spanish aircraft contacted Volta air traffic control. As intentions of the Spanish aircraft were unclear, the Volta air traffic control took precautionary action. As a result of these appropriate and timely actions undertaken by the Volta air traffic control personnel, there were no flight safety implications during either incursion. Airbus incursions are detailed budget by the Ministry of Defense because they have the radar which records the activity. As with incursions in British Gibraltar territorial waters, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office protects all incursions by Spanish state aircraft to the Spanish authorities.
Speaker, since I filed the question, I think there's been further incursions certainly reported by the BBC. One thing was another aircraft which was still flying in the southern part of Gibraltar, and also there was an incursion in Gibraltar, British Gibraltar territorial waters. Can the Honourable Member provide further details in relation to those if it does happen?
I'm afraid I don't have details of I'm aware of it happened, but I don't have the details of the incursion that the Honourable Member refers to, but we'd be happy to provide the details to him at a future date.
We now move to government motion, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
have the honor to move the motion standing for my lord to agree as follows. I just move on the standing order 59 to proceed with the suspension of standing order number 19 in order to proceed with government motion.
Those in favor? Those against? Carried.
The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Gabriel, to move the motion standing in my name, which means as follows. This House approves the mutual information document for the referendum to be held on the 19th of March 2020 on the amendment to the Crimes Act, which has been circulated to all honorable members. As you see that this House was able, in the latter part of last year, I recall, to work together in producing the question and the paradigm on which this referendum will be held. Although there may be divergent views in the House as to whether there should be a referendum or not, or indeed what the result of the referendum should be, and how different members may exercise their rights as citizens to vote in answer to the question that is being put, we were able to work to ensure that the mechanics of the referendum were agreed between us, and most importantly, the question was agreed between us. Mr. Speaker, we also agreed that there should be an opportunity for everyone who is going to have the right and the eligibility to vote in that referendum to be informed neutrally of what the issues in the referendum are, and that this should be done in a way that would then facilitate the argument for those who are going to be proposing that voters should back one side or the other, so that the raw material, the amendment that is the subject of the commencement that is being put to people in the referendum should be something that everyone should be able to have a look at for themselves, and that the campaign should know everyone in the community who's eligible to vote has access to. And to do that, this is the mutual information document that we propose that the referendum administrator should ensure every household in Gibraltar receives. Mr. Speaker, working with the government's law offices, the referendum administrator has proposed a text for a mutual information document, which was shown to me, and which has subsequently also been shown to honourable members, in particular, I think, the leader of the opposition. And given that we both are going to be proposing different answers to be given in respect of the question posed, I think there could be no better arbitrage of neutrality than somebody who is likely to be proposing that no should be supported, and somebody who is reciprocally, some say, advocating that yes, it should be supported, should be the ones that have the ability to input on whether the document is neutral, and indeed the whole House would have the ability to, during the course of this motion, propose such amendments as they might think is appropriate to the document. So the document is now before the House. I am satisfied that it is neutral in presenting the issue in the referendum, the question in the referendum, the existing law, and the amendments to that law. And I understand that having had an opportunity to review it, as soon as some changes the Honourable Gentleman has proposed, that it may be possible for the House to unanimously support this document, subject to the debate today, should be the one that is sent as the mutual information document to every household in Gibraltar to be acceptable to every eligible voter in Gibraltar. And I suppose it is probably useful that copies of this document might be made available in the, I don't know whether we call them polling stations or voting stations for a referendum, so that if anybody were to want to have regard again, just before they vote, to the raw material, they should have a couple of copies available there for reference. So, Mr. Speaker, I commend to the House that we should approve the mutual information document which has been circulated to members and which has the benefits of the input of the referendum administrator, the government offices, the representative of the government, and the representative of the opposition, which happen to be representing or advocating different votes in the referendum, and therefore that this is a mutual information document. I commend, therefore, the motion to the House.
I now propose a question in the terms of the motion moved by the Honourable the Chief Minister. Honourable the Leader of the Leader. Mr. Speaker. We will be supporting this motion, and so before I start, the fact that I have these many terms in front of me is not because I'm going to start referring to them. Difficult to use overall, but rather because I'm just trying to get the notes, my notes closer to my eye. I just over now that I know that the lecture that we have behind us is rather uncomfortable. And the slender version that has been designed for the officer, which is also the course for eyes over, as the prerogative of any of that. I'm fine with it. Mr. Speaker, we will be supporting it's important to note the design of a mutual information document in the context of the package of measures that we have designed by consensus. I think it's important to understand where it comes from and the degree of consensus that has been possible. And it's important for me to say so because of a point that I want to make during the course of my intervention. So we feel very much that the mutual information document is part, indeed, of a sequence of steps. First of all, we had the consensus motion back in December. We were able to agree, despite the fact that we take massively different views on the issue itself, the substantive issue, we were able to agree a motion which defines the process and mechanics for this referendum. Indeed, we were also able to agree the question itself, the drafting of the question. There was a few meetings before the motion was presented by the Chief Minister where we were consulted on those issues, and we were able to do that. But it is also part and parcel of the package which forms the rules of the referendum, which, albeit, I made the point yesterday, we were not consulted on those. But the rules themselves are indeed designed to ensure a degree of neutrality and fairness. Indeed, that is the whole purpose of the rules, overseen by the referendum administrators. There has been now a designation of bodies, an entity that will say yes, and an entity that has a case for no. And there are restrictions on other people to campaign. And indeed, in the rules, there are broadcasting restrictions to ensure equality of treatment. All those are important principles around which this document should be seen. The document itself is not one to be seen in isolation. It's in the context of that attempt to deliver neutrality, fairness, equality, and fair representation. The document itself, Mr. Speaker, we have gone through the document. We have suggested some changes which have been taken on board. The document was first discussed, or at least the concept of the document was first discussed, which you can still really remember when we had the private meeting on the possibility of a consensus motion, the idea that there should be some kind of information about official nature which would go out to each household. Guide the voter, if nothing else, because we are conscious that campaigners on both sides may present the argument in the best way that they think is in their interest, but not necessarily perhaps with strict adherence to perhaps what the current law or the future law does. So there was a need for this document. This document is as short as it could be. It summarizes the current law. It summarizes the future law, it summarizes the effect of voting yes or no, and then it connects to the current law and indeed the law that is being proposed. So we are happy in the summary of the legal positions that it does adequately, fairly, and neutrally present the issue, and for that reason, we will be supporting the motion to approve the draft that we have seen and indeed signify our approval to the referendum to be referred to on the document
as I say, has been the subject, indeed, of some public comments, not just on the motion itself, which is really an indicative few people as far back as December, that there would be such a mutual information document because it was contained in the motion that was passed by the House in December. It was also discussed recently on television. There was a resignation of the campaign bodies for both sides recently, and there was an interview, the referendum administrator in the context of that. There were then some remarks by the Chief Minister, also about the mutual information document. I imagine that he was asked by the GEP for some comments during the visit of a neighboring mayor. It seems to be all part and parcel. Sometimes I understand that the press, when they catch a minister or a member of the opposition, and one issue, they also ask for a standby to something else. I took it that was the case. I will make the point to the Honourable the Chief Minister that I did think, I have to say, that some of his remarks, or at least the tail end remarks, was inappropriate. And I think so in the best way possible. But I want to explain why, because there were then subsequent comments that seemed there was a ding dong between the Chief Minister and one of the campaigning bodies. And I have to say that I think that perhaps the Chief Minister has not understood the point that was being made. My reaction, I have to say, when I first saw the interview, because the interviews that were played by the BBC, there was a straight back interview by a referendum administrator, straight back as you would expect it to be, because he was being asked about protest and he explained that indeed that he had designated the campaign body that day, one for yes and one for no, and that's what he explained. Immediately after that, and in the context of that, there was then a short interview with the Chief Minister where he was explaining the importance of neutrality and fairness in the referendum, and indeed for respect. And I have to say that I agree with everything that he said, except for the last word. And when I say I agree with everything except the last word, it's not because I may disagree with him on the substance of the position. What I was disagreeing with him is that he should express a view of that moment. And I want to make that very clear to the Honourable Member that I have no issue with the Honourable Member expressing his view on the substance of the issue at any time. He's free to do so, as indeed we are. I made the point to him on the motion of the 20th of December that I did not think it was appropriate for politicians to campaign. I made the decision between campaigning and expressing a view. He said at the time he didn't agree with me, and that's fine. I also understand that, and we can take a different view as to whether there should be a distinction between campaigning and expressing a view. My point, and why I think his comments on the Monday interview were inappropriate, were because it was just after the referendum administrator with his straight back interview on designation of campaign bodies. It was just after, within the context of him explaining to people the importance of respect, neutrality, and fairness. And I just remind the Honourable Minister, if I may, because I made a note of exactly what he said. And he said, and this is why I want you to understand the point that I'm making. He said, it's important the information should be put out there neutrally, and so campaigns can comment on their particular views on that information. I will be bringing a motion to Parliament to approve the neutral information document to be sent to every household eligible for the referendum administrator so that the campaigns can bring their own views to bear. So he was talking about the importance of respect, neutrality, and fairness. So then when he then immediately Jesus, in the same breath, went on to say that he would advocate that people should vote yes for a particular reason, that is what I thought it was inappropriate. Because what he was doing an interview on was the importance of respect and character and fairness just after the referendum administration had designated two bodies in the context of each body being responsible for the continuing on the issue. So he accepted at that and not commented any further. He is then free, separately, to comment as long as he wants on the issue. And I know he reacted quite badly at the letter that was received by the referendum administrator from the pro-life movement, but that's why I say I think he misunderstood where they're coming from, because what they said in their letter was that they thought that at that moment, when the Chief Minister proceeded, I'm reading from the letter, to express his partisan and disputed opinion, or barely disputed, the way that the broadcast was put out there, and again I'm reading from the letter, reached basic concepts of fairness and impartiality. So what they were addressing there was not the issue of whether the Chief Minister can, as a matter of principle, express his view on this or no. That's not what they were saying. What they were saying is, at the moment, and I have to say, as a viewer, sitting at home, I have exactly the same reaction. Not only that, Mr. Speaker, I have to say that I was rather taken aback, again, as someone who was reading the reaction in the press. I was rather very taken aback by the people's questions on government of Gibraltar on this. I mean, there are different views within the government. I know that by majority they support one particular view, but you know, at least one minister does it. But even so, there was I was quite surprised at a press release which not only hit out at GPLM, but rather complained that they were suggesting that his right to freedom of expression was somehow being constrained, and worse still, Mr. Speaker, singled out two individuals repeatedly in the press release by name, implying that they were seeking to restrict the Chief Minister's right, in no uncertain terms, Mr. Speaker, giving those two individuals a public facing ban. And Mr. Speaker, when there was a live complaint to the referendum administrator, Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister needs to understand, and I'm sure he does. I'm sure he does. Because, you know, the Chief Minister is not a fool. He called him a fool the other day, but he is not a fool. He understands what he is saying, and he understands what he is doing. And in doing this, he understands perfectly well what he is doing. And he needs to use the effort of the Chief Minister in a responsible and measured way. He is not engaging with the Spanish state. He is engaging in a public ding-dong with the entity that has been affecting the country, as Renee campaigned, by the referendum administrator. He is also doing so in response to a complaint that has been received by the referendum administrator. He is putting the referendum administrator in an indigenous position. What is the referendum administrator? He is a civil servant of the DR. When he was seeing a rather, a extreme response from the Chief Minister. He put the referendum administrator himself in a difficult position. And not only that, when he exercises his office as Chief Minister, he needs to do so in a measured
day, there was no call, in my opinion, there was no call whatsoever for me to engage in such a combative way with two individuals that have only done things in their two powerful people. You know, one of them is a former headmaster, and the other person has a track record in caring for people, and what they're trying to do is to put across their views. They were certainly not seeking to constrain the right of the chief minister to express their opinion. I certainly did not think so, and I don't think that anybody else thought that either. And I have to say that the reaction I have had to the chief minister, especially in respect of this matter, has been certainly one of surprise at the fact that the chief minister thought it was necessary for him to engage in that way with his GPL. So, Mr. Speaker, as I said, we thought that reaction in the context of a mutual information document would have been kept in the spirit of what we were trying to achieve, which is to keep it neutral and fair. And in that context, therefore, I am not going to express my view on whether I'm going to support a yes or a no vote in this referendum today. I'm certainly not going to do it today. I'm going to fall short of that because I believe that what we are keeping to is the context of the importance of neutrality, of the information, and of the respect that needs to be given to both sides, whether the advocate that a yes vote or a no vote. I think it's important to lower the tempo. There's been plenty of social media reaction that has been not needed, and perhaps of high emotion. I think it's important to tone it down, and that's why I raised the issue that I raised, because I certainly think from the position that I hold here, it is appropriate and right that I should say that I saw those comments with a degree of surprise at the excessive of them. Mr. Speaker, in terms of the motion and the document itself, I made clear that we are content and satisfied that it is neutral, that it will fulfill the role that it is supposed to fulfill, and for those reasons, we will support the motion.
Mr. Speaker, regarding the neutral document, I consider it an appropriate document. Technically, an objective, and this is what the people will be reading as a guide for the upcoming referendum, so I will be supporting this motion. With regard to what the Leader of the Opposition has just said, I have been following the events that have transpired over the last few days on this issue, and I have to say that I fully support the Chief Minister on what actually happened. I think that whether we agree or not on what he said or didn't say, it's a matter of style, Mr. Speaker. Maybe I would have taken that opportunity to campaign, maybe I wouldn't have, maybe the Leader of the Opposition and the Chief Minister's position would have done so or not, but it is all about a matter of style, Mr. Speaker, and we have to celebrate the fact that we have a free media. And people should be entitled and allowed to express their views. And the main issue here is whether or not we would believe in trust, which I personally do, that the national broadcaster and our newspapers will give equal coverage to either side, but actually trying to point down on any official or on any elected member expressing their views at a moment like this, when we are fully in campaign mode, is trying to strive for freedom of speech, which obviously I'm very much against, and I think it's a slippery slope at this point. So I don't believe anybody should be told what to say, how they say it, because the Chief Minister, that our respective parties will be judged upon that at the next election on the matter of style and substance of our output. And I think that the Chief Minister is perfectly entitled to say whatever he wanted. So I will be supporting this motion on the neutral document. Thank you.
Does any other honourable member wish to speak in the motion? I'll call the mover of the motion to reply. the motion before the House today is only about the Mutual Information Document. So it is quite something to be told in the context of the motion just in the Mutual Information Document, but in the context of the interview just on the Mutual Information Document, I should not have said anything other than referring to matters which are mutual, respectful, fair, and they're going to campaign mode. And to see the leader of the opposition try, and I should say that I don't think he has excuses, to use this as a moment to seek to reprimand the leader of the House, the senior elected political representative of the people of Gibraltar, for having expressed a political view. Frankly, remarkable that he should try and do that. Mr. Speaker, the only thing I want to refer to has been being a ding-dong for the Speaker. I don't think there has been a ding-dong. And he, I think, failed to appreciate what it was that the Gibraltar pro-life movement were doing in the complaints that they made. He calls it just a ding-dong. I don't think he has quoted a little part of their complaint, but given that he hasn't read the bit that complain about where the chief minister expressed the view and about where the broadcaster asked the question and when they broadcast it. Because, Mr. Speaker, as far as I am concerned, not as a person who will take your view in the referendum, but as the senior elected political representative of the people of Gibraltar, I will not accept that anybody in this community should be told where and when they cannot say things other than rules that have been approved by this House. In other words, there is nothing in the rules approved by this House in respect of this referendum or otherwise that tells the Chief Minister of Gibraltar what he can and cannot say anywhere, and it isn't even a slippery slope, I'm not going to give way. It isn't even a slippery slope, people forget that that is the case. A very slippery slope. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, if we did have such rules, they would be curtailing the very freedoms that we all stand for. No, they're not there, Mr. Speaker. The other gentleman is going to pretend to say that the rules in the referendum somehow curtail. I'm not going to give way. The rules in the referendum somehow curtail. No, it cannot be a point of order, something that I just decided not to give way on, Mr. Speaker.
It is the right of the Chief Minister, it is the right of the Chief Minister, because it is worthy to give way to do so. I cannot press the Chief Minister to give way.
No, my point of order, Mr. Speaker, is that you are stepping your own rules. And I have a right to clarify that, really. If he has asserted it, then it is incorrect.
But did you just make a clear comment on
that? Thank you. If there were rules that prevented me from saying what I said, why didn't he make that as the first point when he got up in respect of this motion to say that I had replied that I was acting properly and exercising my freedom of speech in breach of rules that we have passed in this House? Because no, that's not the case. Although it is convenient for him to try and get up now and pretend that there are. Mr. Speaker, it is absolutely clear. Of course I'm not going to give way. Because, Mr. Speaker, the House has already been entertained by the Honourable Gentleman in this alleged attempt to reasonably just put his support for the Mutual Information Document and call for the Chief Minister to consider how he deals with things in his attempt to pretend to be a vanilla and silken voice in this. And what he's doing is promoting those who would seek to prevent those of us who want to support one leg in the referendum from freely expressing our views in that respect. And Speaker, you know, the government that I lead will not have it. Even if he might be of different views in respect to aspects of this, he certainly won't be put in a position where any of us, whatever our views, will not be free to express those views.
of Gibraltar, and indeed we have observed referenda in Gibraltar and elsewhere in recent memory. In all of those instances, the political elected leaders of those communities, including ours, have expressed views in respect of those referenda. And they have done so in the same location, and sometimes with greater verve and gusto in respect of what things that they represented and defended than I did last week or earlier this week. Nobody ever complained about that. That is what gives away that the honourable gentleman is simply speaking by the back door to try to defend those who he supports in this referendum. He says, Mr. Speaker, he says that the people that I responded to are only known for wishing to be kind to people and to look after people. And Mr. Speaker, there might be disagreement about that. Or even though he doesn't realize it. Doesn't he realize that those of us who take a contrary view to the view that he appears to be taking in this referendum believe that Gibraltarian women's lives are being put at risk by those who are vociferously making an argument not to change the law? That Gibraltarian women are being put out of their country to carry out medical procedures, but they have to continue to be carried out whether people vote not in the referendum or no, and that therefore, even though they might come at this from the best and most genuine position, there may be those of us who, from the best and most genuine position, do not believe that their position is one that seeks to protect and to care in the way that others of us believe that we must protect and we must care for our women folk. Mr. Speaker, therefore, I don't agree with him that it was not right for me to respond in what one might call my usual vehement tone. But I think politics is a serious business. And if you don't believe something passionately, don't pretend to come to this house to defend it. I mean, I'm not the vanilla and spoken, Mr. Speaker. I'm not what I am. I stand for what I stand for, and much like the probably the most successful of the blocs I've seen recently, the Honourable Mr. Peter, you know, I stand for what I believe and I argue about what I believe. You know, you might say I'm inelegant. One person's inelegant is another person's representative, and the person that they feel most represented by. I don't pretend to put on a silken cloak to not what I intend to say, which is to promote a side that I'm pretending not to promote, that I'm pretending to be neutral. Not me. Maybe that's him, Mr. Speaker. I stand for what I believe, and I have been very clear in this House, in interviews on the local broadcast and elsewhere, what I will be voting in this referendum and why. And when I am attacked for saying so, I vehemently and passionately and vigorously take the view that I respond in the way that I have responded. It's the only way in which I need to respond. Well, one man's freedom fighting, another man's terrorist, and one man's good person, and another man's bad person. This is a democracy. People choose him, people choose me, they choose her, and more people choose me. So, and that's why I get to do interviews in front of a cassette that says, working for you. That's why I get asked my view, and that's why I give it, Mr. Speaker. So, honestly, Mr. Speaker, I really don't think that there is much to be said about this. But he has wanted to say much about it because he wants to be the hero of the Gibraltar pro-rights movement. And Mr. Speaker, you will allow me to say that I believe that he is cynical in doing so. Why do I believe that? For all the reasons that I told him during the course of the meeting debate back in October, the night before, or 24 hours before the glorious first successive electoral win of the parties and the rallying speaker. He was saying during the course of that interview, Mr. Speaker, that debate, that he believed that this law was about abortion on demand, and that women should instead make complaints to the police about rape or incest, which might then lead to abortion. And as I reminded him then, although none of them have ever been able to
with the law that they say they can produce. If this law, which we are proposing to be commenced, is an abortion on demand law, which it is not, I believe it's an abortion on demand law in the Jakarta Health Authority. Well, this proposed law, the one that we can't draft, the one that nobody has been able to come up with, is an abortion on demand law in a police station. The risk for women having to go into a cell, Mr. Speaker. The disregard, the mental health that these cells have been cared about. Again, it brings motions on these issues, etc., etc., at least rights in London, although he sends those motions, those press motions to the press before I even have a chance of reading his email. There in his genuine attempt to agree something. He says he cares about mental health. In fact, what he should say to the press, Mr. Speaker, is that he cares about the mental health of men. Because when it comes to the mental health of women who might be suffering as a result of an unwanted pregnancy, his argument is, unless it's rape or incest, and you go to the police and they deal with it somehow, mental health doesn't matter to me because it's abortion on demand. This is what they're doing. That is the level of political hypocrisy. So one is required to flesh out to show that the vanilla is actually much more spicy and that the silken is much more cotton, Mr. Speaker. That there is size to the honourable gentleman's attempt to prove himself as the voice of reason, that when he's calling for respect and neutrality, that he's doing is advancing the cause of that which he defends, which is frankly indefensible, in my view, as he knows. So he said, Mr. Speaker, that it was difficult for him to understand why it was that I replied on the legitimate of the government of Gibraltar. From the middle of the book, even he could work out that the complaint was not about saving the government. It was about the chief minister of Gibraltar. And if he tried to read again the complaint, he was seeing the complaint about the chief minister. And the letterhead of the chief minister of Gibraltar is the letterhead of the government of Gibraltar. So, Mr. Speaker, frankly, I don't think there is absolutely anything in what he has said which has any substance or merit. There was nothing extreme in the response that he gave. I did not pick out any individual. I responded to individuals who had signed a letter complaining about the actions of the leader of government business in Gibraltar. I pointed out what they were doing and the potential slippery slope on which they embarked Gibraltar in respect of freedom of speech. And frankly, therefore, Mr. Speaker, I think that there is every reason to expect that this campaign will be respectful and it will be fair, but it will not be neutral because the campaign has begun and the designation of the two bodies and the signing of the order is about the beginning of the campaign. And there we have to have the discussion to defend what we believe. Otherwise, we don't deserve to be elected political representatives of our people. If we're destined to make points on the cheating subject, the other government goes away and says, you're not trying to stay. So you think of the cheating subject, you're not here just to reply to Spain or to the United Kingdom or to say the happy causes. We're here to deal with all of the issues. And you should expect to see that I will not be neutral in this process. Because I do have reactions to what you said, I have to figure to a fault. I have had congratulations for having put the response to those complaining about the start of this referendum campaign in as forthright a way as I thought it was necessary that I could. Those responses have come from quarters I would not have expected, including those who do not agree with me as to how people should vote on the 19th of March. In other words, there are those who defend voting no in the referendum who felt it was inappropriate for there to be a complaint about one of the individuals who wants to support the opposite being on television and being broadcast.
how well he's done now that he's been re-elected as leader and has a straight run, he'll have a lot of that. But he needs to discern who is genuine in the process of doing so. And I take great comfort from the fact that because the people who don't defend my party's alliance and who don't defend my line and this referendum also felt it was appropriate that I should respond in that way. Because indeed, talking about balance and impartiality in the context of the referendum is to attack the broadcaster for failing to provide balance and impartiality. And there is indeed a very slippery slope where people try and affect freedom of speech and try and affect a journalist's right to report and edit in the way that he sees fit. We haven't seen businesses do that in Gibraltar for the past 2 years since the Britain wrote to the Chronicle to tell them that their use of an apostrophe was in the wrong place in relation to the word mortgage, the quotation mark, Mr. Speaker. An attempt to curtail even a journalist's right to punctuation. Mr. Speaker, it's simplifying. But there's an underlying critical reality. There are those of us who accept criticism within the bounds of what is fair and proper and the laws of defamation and libel. And there are those, Mr. Speaker, who seek always to curtail those who don't have their same opinion and to stop us from expressing that view. For all those who defend, say what one feels, saying what one believes, whether it is on my side in the referendum or otherwise, I stand for defending, Mr. Speaker. And I think know that now on both sides of this debate in the referendum. But I still believe that both sides have today been respectful. I believe they have been fair. And I think that this can continue to be the case on the basis of the parties that have been designated in this campaign. And I call in the wider community, those who are involving themselves in the debate as they should, on social media in particular, to show the same respect and to show the same approach in fairness, not to mention individuals by name, not to call them out for their experiences, not to put up photographs of political leaders with their pregnant wives to try and embarrass or somehow turn the debate into the personal, and to really let have a discussion about the criticism. And let's make it robust. And call for respect, it doesn't call for weakness. It calls for debate on the substance of issues. Hard debate, robust debate, not weak debate, but respectful debate. And so, Mr. Speaker, I'm heartened that the Honourable Lady and I see eye to eye on these issues, although we might disagree on many others, and she has penalized it also from the point of view of the attempt to curtail the freedom of the media, in this case the broadcaster, at the same time as there's an attempt to curtail the freedom of speech. And I call the Honourable Gentleman opposite out for pretending to be doing one thing when we all know what it was that he was trying to do. But I do, of course, nonetheless thank him for the thing that he was called upon to talk about, which was the motion and the mutual information document and his approach to that, which was all that we were here to talk about this afternoon. And he decided to take it elsewhere. But that means we know that we are likely to be able to count the unanimous vote of the House in support of this motion and the distribution of the mutual information document. And I should just add, Mr. Speaker, before I sit down, that I've known the referendum administrator now for many, many years. He is more robust than most, and if he felt that he had to pick me up on any issue, he would. He often does during general elections, regardless of what we might think the outcome might be. And he knows that whilst this party is represented on this side of the House, nobody's ever going to complain if he ever complains about us. Thank you very much. I do recommend the motion to us.
I'm now going to put the question in the terms of the motion proposed by the Honourable Chief Minister. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Honourable Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move the motion standing in my name, which reads as follows.
this House acknowledges the huge contribution made by Ezra Bruce to the cultural, artistic, literary, and musical heritage of Gibraltar, and therefore and hereby posthumously bestow on him the Gibraltar Medallion of Honor. From did I start believing, as I started the earlier notion, that this is likely to be a notion that is going to be engaged upon across the floor of the House. But I would believe that we can do that unanimous supporting of this motion. Once I've heard the pictures, because you never know these days, on the most neutral motion, one might end up finding that there are differences of opinion. But in the case of your group, because I doubt that there will be anybody in this House that will want to raise a word against receiving the Gibraltar Medallion of Honor. For a simple reason, Elio Cruz has been in the background of most of our lives. To some extent, we might not even be aware that he has been there. We all know, of course, of La 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 La, which is his piece. He was also an artist in the sense of painting, and I learned that at the recent excellent exhibition of his life's work, which has been organized by Gibraltar Cultural Services and by Alice Mascarenhas, where I saw a body of work which I was not aware of in the previous man. But also in his music, I have not been aware that when we hear the Vincita Europa, the lyric that we are hearing is a lyric from Elio Cruz. And I know that that is a song which is not Gerame Onde la Fin, which is neutral at a religious level. It is a religious song, but I know it is one a song that is known to all those who live in Gibraltar, whatever their religion, if it's been part of what one might call in the name of the old Radio Gibraltar program, part of the soundtrack of our lives, Mr. Speaker. So, but Elio Cruz has been there in the background so often. And when Mr. Anthony Lima was mayor of Gibraltar, he wanted to bestow on Elio the mayor's award. And I recall that Elio was unable to come to Gibraltar to receive the award, and he was presented with the award in the United Kingdom because he was then elderly and he found it difficult to fly. And indeed, once the government was made aware through the work of the Gibraltar Cultural Services and Alice Mascarenhas and the whole body of work that Elio Cruz represented, he considered it was appropriate that he should indeed receive the Gibraltar Medallion of Honor. Unfortunately, Mr. Speaker, and I say this with a genuine heartfelt manner, this award will be posthumous because of the group has recently passed away. But it's not a reason that his family and his memory did not have the Gibraltar Medallion of Honor in his history and in his body of work as a final exclamation mark to record the pleasure that he has brought many generations of Gibraltarians and the pride that all future generations of Gibraltarians can take in the body of work that he leaves behind, and I therefore commend to the nation to him.
I now propose the question in terms of a motion moved by the Honourable Chief Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I wish to reassure the First Deputy Minister for the role that he will have the unanimous support of the official opposition on this side of the House in respect of this motion. Indeed, it is only right and fitting that Daniel Cruz should be honored with a piece being brought in a Daniel of Honor. And if I may, Mr. Speaker, as a contribution and something I want to be recorded, I would struck and wholeheartedly agreed with the summary of the obituary written in respect of Elio Cruz when he died in June last year. Whereby the journalist summed it up nicely by saying he was encyclopedic on the arts, music, and culture in general. His mind was always constructing and working on his next project, his next play, or working out how the set had been changed so fast in the latest production he has just seen. This is a speaker, those are lovely words by which to be remembered. In his summary, the Minister gave us a brief rundown on Mr. Cruz. I'm very happy to also want to record that Elio Cruz was a school teacher by profession and that a school teacher on both sides of his
what his fundamental thing was. And above all, there are many, many people children who are graduates of the men's college where they have been studying. So I'm sure they will continue speaking proud of it. In over the last couple of days, we have seen the graduates of the 2020 edition of the Devoted Gama Festival, which takes place in March, and it is indeed the Devoted Gama Festival where they recruit for the cycle to gain the first standing ovation, if you want to call it that, he was really the writer of Winners of Original Play. He was also obviously the author of a winning play itself. He was also the author of plays whereby doctors ended up getting Best Actor Award, Best Actress Award, Best Original Play. And all those awards are coming with. So certainly there's a whole list of cultural performing arts achievements that we can have there. And in respect of coming out, he seems to have been equally a very well a person. He won several prizes as a painter, having started in the South Institute Art Group, and he seems to have moved on from success to success. And like all painters, unfortunately, perhaps he only realized the better part of his original work after his lifetime. The speaker is really good to know that Emmy Goulton is someone who has come lived away from Goulton for many, many years, never seems to be a vegetarian, I thought. In fact, he used to have a monthly supply before he gave his digital email transfer of correspondence. He used to have a monthly supply with local newspapers sent to him, and that kept him very much for this. And that is what that was his own personal achievement. That is what led him to write that same very successful play, Lalola, and also Alondra and other pieces that came after that. He certainly knew how to bring alive that critical humanitarian women that those of us who have our own have to remember party life. In the early party, there was someone very, very much like Lalola. And although the people who have been in the three times now, it's something for the future. Certainly, we always look forward to events that bring our community together, and it's one of those events that will do so. I had the privilege of seeing that it was a second performance. I mean, it was done to see the first one, the second performance of Lalola. And after that play, I had the opportunity to meet personally earlier. He was a contemporary, very close in age, also to my late brother. And one thing that struck me about Emmy was in just a few minutes, he was a very knowledgeable man. He could talk about anything. But like people who weren't of that generation, he was above all able to talk firsthand about being a young boy, populated to London, and later to Northern Ireland, the hardships they went through, and yet to the room with a smile, because anyone studying the history of the growth of Yugoslavia, and just as a few other people that he was used to do, you've got to empathize with the character, and Emmy Goulton certainly was someone who could play a suitable career, no matter where you are in the world, no matter if you moved to the late 1950s to London, he never lost his suitable career. In fact, he never even lost his suitable career, absent from his manner of speaking. And he was someone that we all very much look forward to meeting wherever he came from Goulton. He was an only child, but this time readily when health permitted him to visit his parents, and unfortunately, as he came into the third dimension, he chose not to come back to the Volta. But I want to add that Elio was beyond the study by a very proud Volterian. Like I said, he never lost touch with the community he grew up with, and above all, he always remained a Volterian at heart. Today, he forms part of our social and cultural history. He lives with us for a moment of time, but his driving force, Lalola, is very much a part of us, with the same dreams and aspirations, and hopes for a better world with that strong sense of identity and belonging. This was Elio personally through and through. He was everything Lalola was, and he is everything that an aspiring people say that he's going for. So we are extremely pleased to support his in this place.
Do you want to go again for calling the home?
Yes, Speaker. Eric Goulton was a operating. And clearly, despite the lack of banter over this man, he managed to enrich our bank of culture and art in the community. So I take this opportunity to ultimately thank this talented man for his services to the culture and the arts, and I congratulate his family for this very deserved honor. Needless to say, I should be supporting the nation. Thank you.
The Honourable John Cochrane.
The Speaker, I rise as the current Minister for Culture to support the motion. And I think, as I do so, I respect the views of all those many hundreds of Gibraltarians who are active in the arts, the performing arts, and the fine arts, and all aspects of culture in Gibraltar. As a very young child, I remember well attending rehearsals of some of his plays, some of which my brother used to take part in the early days of Group 56 of the Joseph Drama Group. And I too knew earlier, later in life, mainly from his dramatic performances and from his plays. And that is very that my predecessor and my friend and colleague, Stephen Miles, a minister for culture, visited earlier, and I'm sure he may want to write something himself, with members and representatives of the Gibraltar Cultural Services and saw the richness of his work. And we're committed to bringing the exhibition that the Chief Minister opened just a few weeks ago. And it really reveals the wholeness of Elio Cruz's contribution to what being Gibraltarian is. I think there might be something more, though, and it may be that we haven't seen anything. One of the things that I didn't know, that he was also a keen photographer. Sadly, there were only two or three photographs that were found and pulled part of that exhibition. I like to think that somewhere, someone will in the future find Elio Cruz's photograph, and that he still has something to contribute to Gibraltar in the future. Mr. Speaker, what can I say? I think that, as I said, I reflect the views of all the community in the arts of Gibraltar in supporting this country.
Does any other honourable member wish to speak on the assistance motion, or would you like to say something to respond?
Mr. Speaker, I want to thank the whole House for their support of this motion. I was struck by something that the Honourable Mr. Thayer said. I think that La Rella has not disappeared just because of tribal culture disappeared. I would put it no higher than this, because I know many Lollards. Even today, although they're mainly less popular. And indeed, what Gibraltarian has not said to themselves or reminded themselves of the title of that play as we sat on the plane to London, whether we're off for a trip with the family or to negotiate the most important concordat with the Foreign Office. You know, every time that someone goes to London, don't you have that thing in the back of your mind, La Lola se va pa Londres? And that's only the pinnacle of this man's work, the most known of this man's work. So this was a mod and santos, immortalizing that local patois 40 years ago, 50 years ago, 60 years ago. So I think this is highly well deserved, and I'm grateful that this motion was passed unanimously. I should have said also that apart from the Board of Cultural Services, Mrs. Alice Pascarenas and Mrs. Crystal Leonard, I think, contributed a lot of material for the fantastic exhibition. Mr. Leonard in particular has been a collaborator of Elio Cruz for many years. Speaker, I suppose, and if we have different opinions about how people should vote in this referendum, I suppose we have many different opinions about what ambiguity next. Wherever Elio Cruz is now, he is now, he must be smiling, watching 17 Gibraltarians presided over by another, having a discussion about the merits and demerits of him receiving such a medal. What a fantastic cluster we might make in the way that we exchange each other. What a fantastic plateau for him to write. Now, wherever he is, we can do perhaps an even funnier play than the ones he's left us with already.
I now put the question in the terms of the motion proposed by the Honourable Chief Minister. Those in favour? Carried.
The Honourable the Chief Minister. I have the honour to move the motion standing in my name, which reads as follows. The Speaker of the House notes the incredible track record of public service of the Honourable Adolfo Canepa, CMG, ODE, CMH. Takes note of his long service as a voter from the moment he was first elected to the House of Assembly in 1972. Recalls that he served as Chief Minister from 1987 until 1988 and as Government Minister from 1972 until 1987. Recalls that he served as leader of the opposition from 1988 until 1992. Recalls that he was Speaker of the Gibraltar Parliament from 2012 until 2019. And further recalls his role as Mayor of Gibraltar from 1976 to 1978 and from 2014 until 2017. And acknowledges that the Honourable Adolfo Canepa, CMG, ODE, continued to serve Gibraltar in roles which are often voluntary and unpaid between 1988 and 2012, and considers that this trajectory of public service is deserving of the highest honour that can be bestowed by this House in the name of the people of Gibraltar, and hereby therefore bestows the freedom of the city of Gibraltar on the Honourable Adolfo Canepa, CMG, ODE, CMA. Mr. Speaker, I think everyone in this House knows that the person who is the subject of this motion, and I think we all know him well. There are few in this community who don't know Adolfo Canepa. Indeed, he's one of those people who is better known to most as Adolfo than he is as Mr. Canepa. And I think that also demonstrates the sort of character that he is, that engendered that level of proximity and approachability. Speaker, I'm struck by the fact that I also was first elected to this House in 1972. A very good vintage it was too. I think that in 1972, the House elected three of the people who went on to serve this community the most in all our history. Speaker, in due course, it elected Paul McFarlane, who's still here. It elected Adolfo Canepa, who was until recently still here after an interruption. And it elected also Joshua Hassan and Peter Isidore. Both of them had already a long trajectory of service and then went on to continue a long trajectory of service. What a vintage it was. I suppose people look at us because we can hope that none of us give as much of that vintage and that we make way a little sooner for others. But certainly, in Adolfo Canepa here was a man who went on to serve from 1972 onwards. And I'm struck whenever I speak to Adolfo by the amount of things that he was able to do in those days, courting bipartisan support. So, few people will know that pensions and unemployment benefits were creatures of that time in this House, and legislation brought to the House at that time. And few people will imagine that today we might be able to do that, which it also, I think, relates in his autobiography, and he has often related to me, which is to take a proposal that had been put by Joe Bassano in respect of benefits and turn it into something that the AACR then produced, dove on, and was supported in. And that relates also to issues in respect to the Employment Tribunal and fair dismissal, etc. That level of bipartisan work, Mr. Speaker, which, you know, when you look at history and you think of what was happening in those days, of course, what sticks in your mind is the Bassano versus Hassan, etc. Then you know, it's a broad brush history of those moments. But there was a lot going on under in the background, and I've also found that I was one of the architects and engineers, and not to say the midwives, of exactly that sort of positive bipartisan action, which means that all with a much better community today, with those pension provisions that we have, with those social security provisions that we have, and with those employment rules that we have. Of course, they may have been amended 1,000 times since then, but there would have been nothing to amend if that work had not been done in the first place. And when Adolfo came to this legislature, he came to it from the relative comfort of teaching. And many of you reminded us that there are other teachers in this House today, and we've worked also. That was a part of the work of the unions and self-determination. Here was a man who chose to come into this house and to leave perhaps a more comfortable existence as a teacher because he felt it was right and proper that he should. It's because we all know and also found himself holding the post of chief minister for a short period between 1987 and 1988. That was a period of great political flux in our community. The time of the airport agreement and the issues around that, the end of the argument about the Brussels process in the 84-88 period, or the Brussels agreement was to come back as an issue after 1991. But this was a time of great political argument, and it was very difficult indeed for anybody to have led the ALCR to victory at that time, given what was happening politically. But it shows you that the function of the man was there. He was prepared to lead the party, even though there might have been little chance that the opinion polls at the time were wrong and that they might win. After that period, Mr. Speaker, he went into a period of service as leader of the opposition. He understood that perhaps his political, his part of political time had passed. He then took on other roles in our community, which are not significant because they were not elected. I mean, he was called upon by David Hannah as the minister to start the work of implementing directives, European Union directives. And this figure has not been brought to anybody's attention before. And sometimes, you know, when the debate is had about how many directives were overdue in 1996, little regard is paid to the fact that the existence of directives and the need to spend certain money to Gibraltar law had not been brought to the attention of the Gibraltar government until sometime in the mid-1990s. And we were also out of the House, Joe McCarthy's political advocacy and close personal friend thought he had the integrity to do a job for the government that he had opposed and brought him into government service. And what better demonstration that that was the right choice, but despite the change of administration in 1996, he continued to serve as the Speaker of the Land and the GOC in that role throughout their 16 years in government and with different levels of involvement. Speaker, when I picked up the phone in 2012 to ask Adolfo Ganata to become Speaker of this House, he was, as usual, ready to go. I'm told me, essentially, that I think all of us who have dealt with Adolfo know is common in his approach to anything that he doesn't like, and I'm sure that he will have no difficulty with my disclosing that. He said to me, I very much want to let me talk to Julie. Because he understood, as most of us understand, that going into public life and taking the chair that you have taken gradually into public life and even getting gradually into public argument is something that requires the support of the whole family. And with his Julie's support, he took the chair of the Speaker of the House, and he has served us with absolute distinction as all of our speakers have, Mr. Speaker. He did not always rule in the way that I would have liked, and that's, I suppose, what makes him a great speaker. He did not always rule in the way that members opposite would have liked. No doubt, that's probably what makes him such a great speaker. Looking at a speaker and assessing his distinction is not about deciding how many goals you scored or how many goals the other scored, but about the fact that he was a neutral observer of the proceedings and a magnificent referee of the rules, Mr. Speaker. And he discharged that role until the last election. During that period when he was Speaker, I also had to call upon him to be Mayor, Mr. Speaker. And again, when I picked up the phone with the Deputy Chief Minister, he asked him also whether he would once again take on the role of Mayor. He did not hesitate to tell me that he would, but he won't mind me disclosing publicly, and he said, let me talk to Julie. And of course, in the post of Mayor, in particular, the founder partner of the holder of that office is called upon to be present and involved in ceremonial functions. Minister, of course, that was absolutely right. And so, Speaker, in the recognition that we are giving Adolfo Canepa with the freedom of the city of Gibraltar in this council, I genuinely believe it's going to be one that we will fulfill unanimously and with common joy across the floor of the House. We are also recognizing the contribution to public life in Gibraltar of his family and in particular of his spouse, Julie, who was supportive of him when he made the difficult choice to leave to go into politics, supportive of him in his role as minister, supportive of him in his role as leader of the opposition, as speaker and as mayor on those two occasions. I also often refer to Daly not as his better half, but as his better two-thirds. And I think he will agree with me that he's just underestimating her a little when he does that. And she has our thanks and recognition also in the context of this motion, as well, of course, all of his family. So, Speaker, the people of Gibraltar don't have much to give. So when we give it with love. And I'm sure that we will unanimously want to bestow this freedom on Adolfo with joy and to demonstrate how much we appreciate the work he has given in his life and his life. I commend the vote of joy.
I now propose the question in terms of the motion moved by the Honourable Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, we will absolutely and wholeheartedly support this motion. And also, if I can summarize before I go on to talk in a bit more detail, I think there are several pillars on which I certainly will regard him as a man who has held all the high offices of state in this community. Chief Minister, Leader of Opposition, Speaker. Secondly, a politician of substance and seriousness and dignity, qualities which he are to be admired. Not a populist, not someone of populist superficiality, which sometimes we see in the modern era of politics so often. He was a man who was almost the polar opposite of popular superficiality. He was someone who was serious, dignified, and indeed, as I say, who was always one of us. A man and a family who suffered deep personal tragedy and carried it with great dignity, and still continued to serve. Despite their personal trajectory. And a man who served not just for a few years, but for the better part of 60 years. Like the title of his book, Serving My Gibraltar for Half a Century. Mr. Speaker, people who may have shorter historical memories, may perhaps remember that there was some friction from time to time in the last parliament on occasion when Adolfo was speaker. But I have to say that would be to really judge the issue on a very narrow basis, in no way do the members on this side of the House make that kind of judgment irrespective of what we have been thought on individual issues at the time. It certainly does not overshadow the stellar career of service which Edward Alonso has contributed to this community and for which we must be deeply thankful. Indeed, this honour is richly deserved, as it was when Her Majesty conferred upon him the honour of not just the Golden Key, but the CMG, the higher honour more recently. And when I make these remarks, and now I step back into making some personal observations, I do so, and I'm delighted to be supporting this honour to make our offer, given the freedom of the city, and I do so from the perspective
that certainly I was too young I only voted in one election on which our offer was on the ballot paper. I regret to say that I did not vote for him in that election. But indeed, I say quite clearly that in that election, my election was 88, but I can certainly say that I was brought up in a household where my parents and my grandparents never voted for the LUCR. So when I make my judgment of his career, I do so from that perspective. So I come from a family that were not LUCR voters, and yet I absolutely endorse the comments of the Chief Minister of his great contribution to his society, to our community, and indeed the contribution of the LUCR that I recognize, of which he was a part of for so many years. I also was, of course, much older than I am. So my judgment overall was to a great extent historical and from afar. Although I did have been living from time to time, and if I do commit myself some personal indulgences and reflections on them, the first time I encountered an offer was as a sort of young, nerdy 17-year-old when I came here with some friends of mine, and I sat in a public gallery. And the ACL was in its last term, second last term, it would have been, around about 83, 84, I think it was. And I was actually really struck with his impressive performances in question and answers, batting away the opposition members' questions. I thought in one, the only impressive LUCR minister, save of course for the Chief Minister of the time. I do think he was quite a performer in this house. In the same year, during one of those sessions that we had at school where we were all collected into groups and we were all sent off the ministers, in the old days, I was in a group of five or six students that were sent to see a local in his office that was then, I think, located where Dr. Hassan House is now. And I remember sitting there, and we were, after his explanation of government and so on, and he spoke on topics, men invited questions. And I rather impertinently asked him a difficult question on the commercialization of the dockyard, because that was the topic of the day. My father worked in the dockyard, and I thought it was an appropriate question. I'm not sure he took the question, and he thought that was a good question to ask him. But he was very nice about it, and gave me a very full answer as to the policy that he is here. Much later, around 20 years later, I have to say, or 20, 30 years later, I had the pleasure of dealing with a role for at the Constitutional Court with the UK. Of course, I served in government when he was, as the Chief Minister has said, he was part and parcel of what was then the LSU, the Legislation Support Unit, and the advisory services there. But I dealt with him a bit more. When we had the Constitutional Court in London, and I had the pleasure on one occasion, I remember sitting next to him on the train to London when we were on the way to the Constitutional Court. And as it happened, of course, with everyone who has served this community for so long and at such a high level, his knowledge, experience, and ability to direct and command the discussion on historical political issues was really fascinating. And he observed in his book, described me in his book as knowledgeable on the Constitution during those talks, that it may have surprised him. I'm sure he doesn't remember that I was that upstart to
the doctor. If it remembered that, then it would be that wouldn't perhaps have been such a great reflection. I will, of course, remember Arolfo as a politician, as someone who was forthright, serious, thoughtful, and clear, always, and all major attributes. I think that someone could have in politics. He was, as a teacher, as I said, a minister for 16 years. I've said before, I said it during the ceremony opening of college when we reflected on some comments on Arolfo as speaker, that they were probably really tough years to be a minister. There's no 2 years of being in government really easy, and as the members are opposite know, especially because they're in government now, which is not an easy time to be in government. We were in government during John's sovereignty. But I also see it in government when he was in government at a time with the border closure, with all the pressures that brought to bear, that must have been a really hard time to be a minister and providing for the future survival of this community. That was a real test of what he had to have to make this community go forward. He was a man, I think it's safe to say, as he wrote my understanding, of the progressive centre left, the leftist progressive centre left. At the time when he got involved in politics, when the social security, education, and health benefits he takes for granted were unimaginable, as he has said. So he very graciously used to describe himself when he gives to me a couple of times about his time as chief minister that would be remembered as a footnote in history. I thought that was not just graceful, but it marked, in fact, the real achievement that we should remark on and observe that he is not a footnote, in fact, in this community. He has served the community for 50 years with better service and indeed the achievement of someone who gets to be a chief minister of this community when only a handful of people have been privileged to serve in that role. He's never been able to mind me respectfully described as a footnote, and indeed his time, albeit short, was the crowning achievement of his ministerial career. He was clearly someone who was intellectually brilliant and hardworking. He was, as he says in his book, he observes that in those days there were only a couple of scholarships that were given to people. So to achieve to go to the UK without being privately paid by the parents was a real task. And the fact that he did so was a mark of him as an individual and someone of ability. He was, of course, a teacher by profession, and he brought that to bear. My colleague said where he was the speaker of this house. I didn't directly have experience of that, but I'm sure that was true. He observed in his book that he found it difficult to adjust to being a legal representative after being in government. I know that feeling. But after retiring from frontline politics, he continued his public service in Gibraltar in several roles as the chief minister, as indicated, advisory, mayoral, and then speaker, crowning his long career. This is a richly deserved honor, and it is proudly supported by the
Mr. Speaker, as you will well know from your time as clerk in this House and now Speaker, the majority of motions that get presented to this House are usually contentious and don't enjoy unanimity across the floor. I am therefore extremely pleased to see that in this case, this motion will be enjoying the full support of this House and for very obvious and deserved reasons. Speaker, to you, Mr. Gallagher holds a very special place in my heart and in my childhood memories, of course, having been a firm co-pilot to my late father when he worked hand in hand with him throughout his political life.
This great man served as Deputy Chief Minister in my father's government, later going on to succeed him as Chief Minister on my father's exit from political life. Mr. Speaker, when we think about our own lives and the time given to public service in this very house, most of us expect to be around for a decade or two at most. And apart from the father of the house, Mr. Gilmasana, sitting across the floor, a contemporary himself, old Mr. Ganapathy also has an impressive record of years in public service. Few of us will match an entire lifetime dedicated to political life. And for that, today, we owe Mr. Ganapathy a huge collective debt of gratitude. Because it is people like Mr. Ganapathy who have been there through thick and thin, when the chips are up and when the chips are down, to navigate our community through difficult times and to see us through to the other side. In fact, Mr. Speaker, when we review this political journey, Mr. Ganapathy's contribution to our democratic history is nothing short of outstanding. Mr. Ganapathy, serving as a government minister in the days of the closed frontier, led the revolution of the social insurance scheme by increasing old age pensions and making the scheme universal. Prior to his taking over the labor and social security portfolio, only industrial workers and no-paid white-collar workers were eligible to contribute to the scheme, until Mr. Ganapathy made it universal by including those in the private sector. Including everybody in the scheme was indeed a revolution, and coupled with it, ensured to increase pensions astronomically from £2.10 a week to £6 a week. Mr. Speaker, Mr. Ganapathy will also be remembered for tying annual increases in pensions to average earnings, directives that we take for granted today, but that were pioneered by this good man with true socialist values. Just like introducing the legislation to protect workers against unfair dismissal, legal pathways that protect workers to this day and were brought about under Mr. Rolfo Ganapathy. He then went on to bear the brunt of the closure of the dockyard, attending meetings with my late father on the late Baroness Thatcher in London, to secure the future of the dockyard, achieving a very beneficial pathway to raise for our people. Mr. Speaker, Mr. Ganapathy has dedicated his life to public service, from his teaching days right up until a few months ago, when he was Speaker of this House, where we have seen him diligently apply the rules of this House, often with passionate altercations with his most distinguished predecessor of yours, Mr. Speaker, altercations and heightening of tensions, which I think I'm sure we will all fondly remember him for. He has served as government minister, deputy chief minister, leader of the opposition, mayor, speaker, but most importantly, Mr. Speaker, he has served as a man of our people for almost 5 decades. I will therefore proudly and emphatically be voting in favor of this motion to award Mr. Ganapathy his most distinguished honor, and I congratulate him and his family for this most wonderful honor and take this opportunity to thank him for his years of dignified service. Mr. Speaker, I also take this opportunity and echo the sentiments of the Chief Minister about his wife, Julie, and thank her for being his rock and his motivation in delivering his great work to us with the determination and elegance with which he has done so over the decades. And this lady has been a clear key factor in Mr. Ganapathy's success and service to our community, and she must not go underestimated here today. As the old saying goes, Mr. Speaker, behind every great man is a great woman. Thank you.
May I also remind honourable members that the office of government is not on the case. Does anybody else, any other honourable member, wish to Mr. John Cassell?
Mr. Speaker, to support of the motion is on the outstanding personal reservation list. The exception that proves the rule, and the honourable chief minister said earlier rightly that Adolfo is known as Adolfo rather than Mr. Ganapathy. There are at least 2 exceptions in this room, Mr. Speaker, because both the honourable Mr. Leavitt and I were killed by him in Form 2A in the Devoto Grammar School, and for us, he always has to be Mr. Canada as well as an airport. Speaker, when Ronald Collins won school Korea, you remember most of your teachers. Usually one or two stand out. When I recollect my school Korea, my teacher was Mr. Canada. He was a strong teacher, he was a caring and understanding teacher, and he had the respect and most important, despite his friendliness, the affection of everyone he taught. And every teacher I remember as a teenager, a young teenager, I must have been, when I heard that he was standing for election, I remember having a conversation with my late father. So what happened now? That he had to leave the teaching. And I was so upset that he was going to have to stop teaching. That is because education's loss was the greatest gain. I also had the honor to work as a civil servant for some years when he was NEDT, as we used to call it, Minister for Economic Development and Trade, and he was also chair of the Development and Planning Commission. I'm correct in saying that he was probably one of the first, if not the first, full-time ministers in the government of the Volta, at a time when this just wasn't done. So once again, a pioneer in that. But above all, Mr. Speaker, I have just to comment that Mr. Canada had also taught me a lot more than mathematics and a lot more than Arsenal football club, which he is known as a strong supporter, but he taught me values. And not just me, but many manageable failures. And I think, apart from all the contributions in the political world, I think his contributions in education and in teaching a lot of then young people, now not so young people, that in the room themselves merit the honor that this house is going to be saved.
The Honourable Edwin Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes, together with my colleague, Professor Protest, we certainly remember for that. But I couldn't have put it better myself. He was a big man, but fair. I mean, each of us, as you said, and I think he was a man who is a colleague in the teaching profession. I remember he certainly made my day, this must have been 1971, and he was one like myself who was minority, the supporters of the government. But because often the man who was seen to be double in that year, I certainly to have teacher who was at the time, stand up in the top of the steps in the lower playground. And he expect all the boys as he walked up and they told God, I mean, you have the wrong style of church or style. But the saving was that we had to also help us. Because, you know, the fact that we were able to have much longer hair now. And he actually stopped there, put my hand and said, congratulations, you did it. And he said, maybe my day, my career, 7 years old, or my 30-year classmate, you know, how great is my soul, you know, because he was always careful not to single any people out, either to reprimand them or to take them. He was always being there. He was indeed a kind man, but he was a sportsman as well. I remember during his early years as a full time minister, and in fact, during his first term as mayor, he would often turn up at the weekend in the days of the first frontier to Victoria Stadium or to the open sports ground and sit there fighting on a Saturday or Sunday and watch any of our events or cricket. I mean, he always had nice words, but very accurate, you know, to comment on you. The fact was his personality and his practice and the other. And our mayor, he made that involved that difference because the difference is James would be to this, he was a reason to set up a little mayor to vote, and then they really thought he had brought out the red carpet for that team. I have one memory as well, having had the success of my life. I had applied for a rather senior teaching job, and it was a full CSC board meeting. And my name was called in, and I went into the interview room, who was there to share the whole thing. Well, Mr. Canavan himself, but my thoughts rushed back to the 30 years earlier, so especially if I don't stand a chance in hell of getting this post. But in terms of the qualified service and judgment, which you have to join me in both for the last, Mr. Canada, and for your continuous and enemy support, like myself, to
we're always behind that. So thank you for your service, Mr. Paul.
The Honourable Sir Gilbert
Sanders. Well, Speaker, I can say that I share the privilege and the opportunity of being a friend of all friends from before politics and from the school days. That is to say, we are the same age. Who were in the same school. We really are sitting back in the same place because, of course, at the beginning of my involvement in politics, everybody used to belong to the ASEAN. We were either an ASEAN or an independent, and the level of success were all ASEAN. And it was indistinguishable from being in the ASEAN and being in the Union because the ASEAN. In something perhaps unique, because in most countries it is the trade union movement that first starts campaigning at an industrial level and then finds that it has to enter the political level to get beyond what they can do within a framework which can only be changed politically. But in the voter case, it was in the reverse direction. The AACR actually created the trade union movement instead of the trade union movement leading to the creation of a political arm. So the trade union movement here was the arm of the parties, rather than, as was the case in the UK, that the unions eventually decided they had to enter the political arena in their own right instead of lobbying. And the AACR was the left wing of Gibraltar, not just at the center, it was the left. And I think it was a period of time when the main issue, whether it has not yet terminated as far as we are concerned, and I think now perhaps even as far as they are concerned, since the Honourable Leader of the Opposition shared their view with us when we were speaking from the top of the Cambridge Clubhouse for many years, is that it has not yet been won and not yet finished. But certainly it's a battle that the AACR led, which was a battle for decolonization, for self-determination, for the recognition of the Gibraltarian. And many of the things that make being in politics difficult were precisely the colonial layer. And I also was as much a campaigner against colonialism as I was, even though we were on different in the South, and we were in different sites in the South initially precisely because of our views on decolonization. The issue with the position that was being taken by the ASEAN on the future relationship was going down this route, which was unanimous at one time with Peter Isola and Professor Boltzoy. With the same view to the United Nations on free association, or close association with the United Kingdom, and the position then was that the flaw in free association was precisely the ability of the United Kingdom to cut the union, to cut the link. Free association carried a risk in a situation where even at that early stage in the 1970s, it was obvious to those of us who were involved that we were being pushed in a direction that we didn't want to be. And being in government in the 1970s with a close frontier, even in 1970, even early in 1972 and 73, people in London were already planning what was going to happen after 1975 or 76. 77, whenever it was that the dictator had gone by, because it was going to happen within a matter of years, and they were preparing for what was going to be, from the perspective of the foreign office, a different scenario. The defense and the protection of the voter, which are always taken for granted, was being put at risk the moment that people saw a need to give comfort to the newly born democracy in Spain in order
to ensure that it didn't fall back into the hands of a military dictatorship. And that meant that for the first time, after Franco's death in 1975, the Bulgarians were seen as having to have the defense of and protection of their interests put on balance with the need to provide warmth and support to the people on the other side. It was a very difficult time to be in government. I was not in government, I was in opposition. And of course, in the domestic matter, the relationship with Europa was a very close one. I mean, he had been in the trade union movement, he was a full teacher. He came into politics at a time when it was very difficult for working people to come into politics because there was this untaxed allowance, which is a sort of pocket money for part-time politicians. And the law said that, as it originally was in the 1970s, practically nobody ever ran those in the private sector to self-reelection. It was, the public sector included the Ministry of Defense, the DOE, the Government of the Malta, the City Council. So you were only able to go into politics in Gibraltar, really, if you had the ability to be self-employed, or you were in the private sector, or you had to get your livelihood and go in the hope that you get into government and get £750 a year allowance, or stay in a position and get £350. That's the difference. Of course, in the private sector, as I discovered when I came back, if you were branded as a Bolshevik, it didn't have much of a standard being offered employment. My wife and three children, one on the way, really, the only home available in the Bolshevik was the union. But, and also, in our first exchanges in this house, introduced a piece of legislation which the Honorable Lady has referred to, which is the position against unfairly dismissal, which is the law we have today, which has been introduced in the United Kingdom by a Tory government as a threat to the union because they were introducing negative things for women. And in order to get them sort of, they were offering something to similar things, but this is a thing of the trade union regulations. And that is, I remember that was a thing that was also made. And also said, in the United Kingdom, it is a right-wing government. The ACL in those days was very close to the Labour Party. And he said, it's a right-wing government that has introduced the protection for workers in a competitive system. And he stood there on the team of introducing controls on trade union rights. And we are introducing the figure without a figure. And this is how we start the law, because in fact, the law is the protection to workers. And our law was the first law in Europe to protect, because it was being done only in the UK. And for many, many years, and even to this day, there are places in Europe to no longer law for unfair dismissal. And in the United Kingdom, the period of time has been cut back to 6 months sometimes under the early years of Labour, and then put back to 2 years under the Conservative government. We've always had the 52 weeks of the original legislation of 1972. It was introduced in the United Kingdom in 1972. We introduced it here shortly after in 1973. And there have been two important pieces of legislation where I've also sat on this side and I sat on that one, but we were very close in what we wanted to achieve. In the case of unfair dismissal, there were a number of things that I proposed to improve the legislation, and I also was quite happy to delay the committee state to sit down with me and discuss how what I wanted would work. And this is right at the start. We had only been here for a few months. So, the personal relationship, the personal warmth, the affection we have for each other, never got interfered with by any differences that we might have politically because we were on different sides in the house. And indeed, in many, many occasions, I think there were with a close frontier and the possibility of MLD cards, and the United Kingdom Foreign Office saying we're going to move in the direction of getting closer to Spain and talking to Spain. Many decisions in those years were being taken where the people in government that were taking them and defending them were not 100% convinced that we should be going in that direction. And not only do I know that from my personal relationship, but in fact, the status that gets published after 30 years in the United Kingdom shows that the people that sat in the Foreign Office knew that the Gibraltarians were going to be difficult in moving to where the UK currently should be moving because that was no longer there. You know, there has been a problem making people understand in London that it was all going on. Gibraltarian in his right mind would vote to be put under a dictatorship. And finally, 44 of them wanted to be under a dictatorship in the first referendum. So it's not impossible, but I mean, what is incredible is that 44 people could actually vote to join a government that doesn't know right at all. They vote in the opposite direction. And they didn't understand that if there is a democracy in Spain, it doesn't alter the fact that we are a different people with our own identity and our own rights. And that is the one thing that is most important about the work we do politically. And the most important about the work that I also have done in this life, and I have that in mind when we talk for the things that we should do. And that is that this is all about our survival as a people. When we talk about recently in the previous notion of granting the freedom of assistance to somebody that has captured and encapsulated the identity of our people. Look, that is what we are. We are the people in our own right. We fight with each other, like every family, because we have different views about what is best for the family. But we can never put the family at risk. And the reality of it is that we start to work at best when we know that if there are things that are too important to be allowed to, for us to have the luxury of quarreling with each other and putting what is important at risk, we all are mature enough to realize that we need to make sure that this is removed. And then, when there is this reason, we will not fight each other again. And it's important that we continue to do that because it's been easier to do when somebody like me has been on that side or on this side dealing with somebody where the fact that we didn't belong to the same political party and that we have taken different routes was a minor difference in our view about our view on what we should be doing to protect labor, on what we believe in social security, on what we believe in protecting the economy of Gibraltar, on what we believe about defending the rights of our people. The marginal differences were the result, I think, more of reacting to the United Kingdom and where the United Kingdom was putting us with Brussels and Lisbon and Brussels than in anything that was internal. In the internal, we were always able to do things in a compromised way because we were not that far apart ever before. And I believe that we're doing something that we need to do to thank the Lord for everything that we have put into getting us where we are today. And I believe that I also would want me to say that we hope that those that come after us will be as committed to our homeland and love our country as much as I know we does, and we know we do.
Was a key figure in the political politics when I first grew an interest in it as a close teenager.
in the late 1980s, he was appointed to the Suffolk Office of Regulation in the midst of the politically controversial signing of the Air Force Agreement in 1987. But the Gallup administration was to be a short lived one. As he says, it was just over 100 days when he was appointed chief minister on the 11th of December 1987 to when he called the election for the 24th of March 1988, which was won by the group of people left subject to the father of the house. The Gallup, as the motion spells out, has held many political positions in Gibraltar, like the chief minister, leader of the opposition, speaker, and mayor. So this piece has been justly proud, and we are quite properly recognising in the passing of this motion. It is not, however, as it's been alluded to by various members here today, in a bed of roses. As anyone will know from either talking to him, as I do very often, or reading his memoir that we have here entitled Serving My Gibraltar, in many respects, participating in public life was a huge, represented a huge personal, a real sacrifice to him and his family. Again, as we alluded to earlier, he had to give up his job as a teacher, for which he clearly had a passion and he loved, in order to fully enter the fray and become minister at a reduced salary. And I wish to read some of the excerpts from his book where he talks about this. And he says, "I've been told over the phone that Bolton had unexpectedly called an early election and sent him what the purpose of the meeting was. Julie told me before I left that he supported me fully, and that I could seize the opportunity to stand for election, which I might later regret not having done so. I therefore agreed when asked by Sir Joshua to stand for the 1972 general election. Julie's support was vital. For me, it meant that she would have to continue to teach as the main breadwinner of our family, which then included our three young children. As deputy head of the grammar school, I had been earning over £1,750 per annum. Even if elected into government, I would only earn £700 per annum as a minister. Less than a labourer who was earning £14.50 per week at the time. It was a considerable sacrifice in financial terms, apart from the fact that I may never be able to return to teaching again. Public life, and in particular holding ministerial office in the 1970s, as again has been alluded to by the leader of the opposition, was far from easy. Not only was Gibraltar opening operation under a very frontier situation, it was also subjected to much industrial strife when the unions were, dare I say, at the height of their militancy. And I refer to one particular episode of the Honourable Mr. Easter would be interested to hear, where we saw and experienced in this house the outpouring of that militancy. And if the house with me, and this is a book which I highly recommend, I must say. I found it very, very interesting when I read it now 6 years ago. So, on the 27th of September 1974, the Joshua, with the support of his ministers, outrightly rejected the concept of charity, which was also at the time an anathema to the NAD, as stated by Roy Hattie on behalf of the Labour government, then in office in 1990. Soon the local unions commenced a period of intense industrial action, as the Honourable Mr. O'Farrell recalls. And on the 17th of December 1974, which happened to be my 34th birthday, a very hostile crowd gathered outside the House of Assembly before the commencement of the meeting. Government were abused and jostled as we entered the building and the police had to protect us. The members of the opposition had no problem, so they supported charity. Ironically, later that day, when all members were effectively imprisoned in the house by the crowd and stones were thrown, one of those stones broke through a window and nearly hit one of the members of the opposition, Mr. Peter Easterman, which I didn't know until I read it from the book. So yes, very tough times indeed. One of Adolfo's comments which he had made to me and has stayed with me and stuck in my mind was when he told me some years ago, I think at the time it was the many conversations that I had with him, that, and he said, he like that, it's out of fasting the world now. So the goal says he's in 2000 now, and of course he's making a reference to how difficult it was during that decade of the 1970s. Then, as political fate has it, despite many years of the loyal service as an AACR minister and deputy chief minister of successive AACR victories in the Hills, 1972, 1976, 1980, 1984. He only had about 800 days in the top job. Some say that he should have been given more time in office in Berlin and bring his own character to play as perhaps even his own legacy. An earlier transfer of power may have allowed him to put up a better fight as the election that he was bound to call in early 1988. And we will never know what would have happened had he been given that opportunity slightly earlier. And Speaker, and this is the final excerpt I'd like to read from the book, which encapsulates the point I've just made. I couldn't help recalling what JUCI had told me in front of the Supreme Court shortly after I became a Chief Minister, and this is JUCI told me. You have been left soldiers in the Canada. JUCI and I had buried the acrimony of the 1980 general election in the past. And then he goes on and says, when he remarked to his father, who had also his father, what JUCI had told him, apparently had also his father told the also, he grinned, the candle that you're holding has no witness. I think it really encapsulates what Alonso went through during that very difficult period in his life. Mr. Speaker, I would like to end simply by saying that all of this activity in politics came at a significant cost to himself, his beloved wife Julie, and his very young family. So that in some measure, and I am sure Alonso himself would agree, this happening that we are bestowing on him today goes not only to him, but I think also to Jimmy and his children, Henry, John, and Michael. And of course, we will support this on this matter.
Does any other honourable member wish to speak?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Much of what I said will be said by many honourable members, but I think that's important to so, to welcome and support the motion taken by my humble friend, the Chief Minister, and I do so as someone who has known or heard from Adolfo Canada almost since I was born. Adolfo is a stalwart of the water politics. I have no doubt as to the merit of this award, and it is something which is extremely well deserved. And the special emotion spells out the freedom of the city is the highest honor that this house can bestow in the name of the people of the vote. As you have heard, Adolfo has enjoyed a long and exemplary record of public service. It was so less impressed in 1972 under the banner of the AACR, won the election and served as Minister for Labour and Social Security. And it was then part of the William Stevens Fourth Successive General Elections, the Bigelow election of 1972, the Hattersley election of 1976, in 1980, and the Dockyard General Election of 1984. He has been number two for his time as Minister for Economic Trade and Development, and also as Royal Deputy and Trust today to the then Chief Minister, Sir Joshua Hassan. Speaker, there are only two devotees who have served as Chief Minister, Leader of the Opposition, and Speaker of this House. For the Minister, as I've been said, is one of them, and the Lord for Canada is love. That's part of history, I think, that we do. I also want to touch briefly on this book, Serving Michael Goldstein. It is, to me, an honest and a fascinating account of his life, which covers both the political and the personal. And I too had the opportunity of reading it from cover to cover, and I certainly enjoyed and thoroughly recommend it as well. Because it is through those pages that we learn who Adolfo Canada is, and in a sense, what Adolfo Canada is all about. It is about teaching, as we heard, for example. He made a very real financial sacrifice when he opted for public service, not even in those days, the with a young family.
And the rest of the book also about the high points and sadly, to about the sad points, the low points of Tess's life, the personal and the political.
Mr. Mayor, he comfortably expected that that contribution was recognized by Her Majesty the Queen with the CMG, CBOBE, and by the House and with the World Trust Medallion of Honor. It is an honor for Canada that is synonymous with honesty and with integrity. It is a long history of someone who made an important contribution to the shaping of the Bulgarian identity, to the shaping of who we are today. A word of tribute to Adolphe's wife, to Julie. I had the pleasure of being sitting next to her in front of that story recently in a dinner hosted by the mayor in the Fifth City Hall. I was assured by the anecdote she encountered with some passion about their early life. And I've also been a pillar strength by his side throughout. So, Mr. Speaker, I congratulate Adolphe and Julie, their children, and all the family. And I'm delighted to support them.
I'll call on
Mr. Speaker, thank you very much.
Mr. Speaker, I start by thanking entirely with the various contributions that members of the House have made. They've outlined our author's achievements. Father and I together hope that we have done. I just want to add a few words, Mr. Speaker. I was, of course, leader of the opposition for 4 years when I was for the Speaker of the House. I probably had more run-ins with the House for that I had that I did with your noble, the Chief Minister. Question time were often 10 paces at dawn. As I, but not with your noble, the Chief Minister, with the Speaker, as I felt the third parliamentary navigate my vocal cords, I could see from the corner of my eye. I've also got a few words that microphone in order to utter the dreaded word, no, followed by the more dreaded word, you are debating, Mr. Speaker. But what people do not see is the mercy of the man, the encouragement that he personally gave me, the support that he gave me behind the Speaker's chair, always understanding, because he was a political animal, because he had sat in that chair as the leader of the opposition, that being the leader of the opposition is always a vital, vital role, that it is in fact a very lonely, difficult role to discharge. And he was somebody that when he said, he wouldn't do so, he didn't genuinely believe when he said that there was a contribution that I had made or some other member of the bench had made that was a good thing, would privately say to me, that was a good speech, that was a good contribution. And I really always appreciated that because it showed a different sense of a man, and you always appreciate that type of encouragement, particularly from that type of man, who was a man of immense experience, immense years in politics, and for him to say he's done well, and for him to be privately supported, meant the absolute role to me at that moment in time. Mr. Speaker, he was also somebody that, and again I speak very privately about this from a personal perspective, that he was somebody that also encouraged me to stand at the last election. And when I was unsure about whether I wanted to stand or I didn't want to stand, he would often have conversations with me, and he was one of the people that encouraged me to say, you must stand, you continue to make a contribution to debate politics. And I think it's important to work with him. And again, that is very much something that I appreciate and that will stay with me for the rest of my life. So, Mr. Speaker, when you
way, because of course in occasions like this, everybody is talking about achievements and about your record and talking about what you've done. But so when you actually strip away those words, when you strip away what everybody has said about, I won't get qualified, rightly, because you deserve it, it's one of those few individuals that can actually take a step back. You can sit down and you can say, that's my record, and you judge me by my record. Not a lot of people can actually say that.
The Honourable Albert Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, very briefly, I've known Albert for a very long time for different reasons to most of the members. He was a great opponent of my father's politically, but also a great friend. And I think that is reflected in many of the contributions to honourable members around on both sides of the House today. But maybe a few words that really tell me what an individual at all for is. For those of substance, he's always a man that dives into the detail and that works hard. Everything he knew was by work and by commitment. And he was a hugely committed individual who put his effort, his full effort, into everything that he did. So as a consequence, he always had substance. Integrity, he's always a man of complete honesty and fairness, so I always regard him as a man of total integrity. And above all else, he was a gentleman. He was a gentleman to anybody and anybody that he came across. And for me to be able to be here today, on a day when we are recognizing his achievements and his contribution to public service, is a privilege, and I'm delighted to be able to support the motion that I am the Honourable Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was, of course, far too young to attend the grammar school and have the benefits of Mr. Gallagher's education, but judging from the results, they must have been exceptional. And of course, in 1972, I was 5 years old, and so I was unable to witness the accession to this house by what can only be called old school politicians. And certainly, in Mr. Gallagher, he has set the bar high in terms of his service to Gibraltar, as we set out in excellent books. And it's a high in terms of the user is a matter of principle. Whether or not I agree with him as speaker, he always held his point of view in a very reasonable manner, I would say. And I do feel honored to have been able in this chamber to have worked in Mr. Canada, but it's not always often that you get the opportunity to work with people who will, in due course, no doubt become pillars of the establishment of Gibraltar and will have their own mythology and legend that will follow them, as indeed no doubt the father has, will have in due course. But I first came across an old book, funny enough, and he probably does not remember it, but certainly I was subjected to the same liberal study classes on the Honourable Revolution. I think it was 1985, 1986. And first from a talk by the father has in those days, where he was espousing his secret economic plan, which he never told me what it was, and he said it wouldn't be a secret in total. I think it's still the case today. But first from Joseph Powell's talk, again, in the same kind of grouping, was sent to Adolfo Gallagher, and he must have drawn the short straw for the government, since he seems to have got all the six forms. But I do recall not asking him about the dockyard, but asking him something else about the point system. And I directed him as to why such a system existed, and as well as much of quality. And I said, well, how can the government decide who is a good or bad student? I put it to him, well, then, the money, I guess, is
companies were things to throw my attention with money. But we've been able to be held in ground in the IOSF and pursue my own career. And you probably forgot the news. But certainly, Speaker, an award such as this is most certainly hard earned and is most certainly well deserving and has my wholehearted support. Thank you, Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, what a pleasure to hear the House join in support for this important motion to bestow our highest honor on Adolfo Galipa. I was struck by some of the things that the Honourable the Father of the House said. And Adolfo Galipa is, like the Father, one of those politicians who says when he is not in power, when it comes to one of the Gibraltar issues, one of the key issues, they say, as Joe Bacana said, and as he has described the politics of Adolfo Galipa, before they get to him, the Chief Minister of Gibraltar, they have to get to me. I always remember at the time of Joe's sovereignty, Joe Bacana getting up and saying that, about the ability of the United Kingdom government to get at the then Chief Minister and the then government, and his right to associate those sorts of sentiments with the type of politician that Adolfo Galipa is and the way that he attended to the issues that he was dealing with when he became Chief Minister and the politics of the AACR and when he became its leader. You were absolutely right to remind us also, of course, Mr. Speaker, that Adolfo Galipa has been one of the few Gibraltarians who has acted also as governor. And so to add simply to the recital of titles that he has held, the positions he has held in the community, not only has he been the leader of the opposition, chief minister, mayor, and speaker, he has also been governor and acting governor in the short period of the first interregnum. And Mr. Speaker, anybody who has held those offices will know, and the Honourable, I think, Mr. Pacino talked about the politics of being a credit worker. Anybody who's held all of those posts knows that if you want a bed of roses, you become a florist and not a politician. And that also kind of has, through the sacrifices he has successfully made, demonstrated that he was ready for politics, aka not the bed of roses. Mr. Speaker, I was also struck and wished that the admission had been made in cross-examination by the Honourable Reverend of the Opposition having told us that in 1988 he did not vote for the AACR. From my historical recollection, the only other parties standing at that election were the GSLP and the Independent Democratic Party. If it had been a cross-examination, Mr. Speaker, the next question would have been, which of the other two did you support? He is gesticulating towards the Father of the House, from which I will take it that the witness is admitted to having voted for the SOP. If that is the case, Mr. Speaker, if that is the case, I have to bring to bear, and I know this could not be about us, but the other members of the government, so often maybe about themselves, that I'm going to fall into the trap. I've now been into the equation my own experience at liberal studies with an Adolfo Galipa, which is a shared experience with the person who didn't stand for leadership of the party opposite, Mr. Speaker. Which was in 1989, when Adolfo Galipa was the leader of the AACR, Joe Bacana was incumbent chief minister, and he came up with the form the GSB. And all three of them came to see us. And I asked a question that has since been referred to by members of the other party of Joe Bacana in relation to tobacco,
And I asked similar questions of people in the report and the Gopher Gallagher. I also asked the Gopher Gallagher how he felt about the GOP and about the GOP having left the party. And he said, no, we're concerned and we're delivering the same building. They're obviously working together in the creation of this new party. Feeling very secure. And I was always struck by those words. I was always struck by those words. So, Mr. Speaker, given what I've also said, if the successor in title of the AACR is the GOP, then the other one that is in the position is leading the party he voted against in 1988. There is no jury, Mr. Speaker. This is not a cross examination. Such is the history of Adolfo Canepa in the political comings and goings of the period that he was key to what happened thereafter. Mr. Speaker, I don't think it is possible for me to withdraw support for a motion I have endured myself, but the Honourable Mr. Speaker has given brings me to the brink of those decisions and tells me that the Walker is responsible for persuading him to stand for election again. I knew he was a kindly man. I knew he was a kindly man, Mr. Speaker, but I didn't quite know how kindly he was. But he's, of course, absolutely right to remind us that there were times at question time where also, Speaker, when all of us felt the strength of an open view as to where debate should happen and where the questioning should happen. And very often I was not allowed to have my own temptation to join as the Honourable Gentleman, which he and I know look forward to with our respective in red, mind, blue light savers, because of an open view that debate has to happen in another part of the proceedings. And I think he's got us into that discipline. He's got us into that, and he's still taught to be yoga. He's got us into that discipline. And now I think we have learned that debate is not the question. Mr. Speaker, so therefore, again, his influence on the procedures of his house, I think, has been great. And the Honourable Lord Deputy Professor referred to what it is that Adolfo's life has been synonymous with, and he gave a number of examples. I think from my own contribution and the reason for my bringing of this motion that I prepared with the Deputy Minister, and he's also in this motion, is that Adolfo is, Adolfo's name is synonymous with service. Service to this Gibraltar, to my Gibraltar, as he calls it, to our Gibraltar, as it is for all of us. I think the one thing we have not said yet is that he also agreed to chair the Commission on Parliamentary Reform and prepare the report of that, which is a responsibility he took after the 2011 general election. He quickly turned that around, and that was a very useful instrument which we are now going to, I hope, take further in the select committee. The figure, of course, something has been said in the last meeting which I cannot agree with. The father of the House will not one day be a huge legendary figure. The father of the House is a legend in his own political lifetime, and there are very few who can achieve that. And the father has loved being talked about, loved being praised, and will love my reminding the House that he doesn't need a fraction of time to be legendary. And of course, there was a debate about 1988 about the secret economic plan, but the secret economic plan cannot be secret to anyone anymore because it was implemented from 1988 to 1996. So I'm surprised that some still refer to that as a secret economic plan when it's lying in plain sight. But this is an important correction of the record. Mr. Speaker, I think everybody who has spoken during the course of this debate has spoken from the emotion of affection for the subject of this motion, and also Canada. I think it is recognized as one of the great Gibraltarian politicians. I think he is recognized as a giant of this community, and as such, as a right of this community to bestow on him the greatest honor that we have in our gift to bestow, which is the freedom of this fair city of ours. I'm grateful for the support of all members of the House of this motion, and I commend the motion.
I now put the question in the terms of the motion proposed by the Honourable the Chief Minister. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
Bills, first and second reading. A bill for an act to amend the Input Elections Act 1986, the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister. I am eligible that a bill for an act to amend the Import and Export Act 1986 be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Import and Export Act 1986 be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Import and Export Amendment Act 2019. I would like to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, the bill before the House today is a consequence of our departure from the European Union. This is one of a number of Brexit-driven legislative measures which are designed to protect the position of the voter going forward. It should also provide flexibility and speed on matters that have to be processed urgently. As Ben explained during the debate on the European Union withdrawal agreement bill, that the government is working to provide an alternative international legal framework for the voter outside the European Union. In other words, the existing framework, which is based on EU law, will be replaced by a wider framework, which is based on other international agreements and conventions. This policy is taking place across the board. The bill before the House today is part of that strategy. The equivalent of the bill contains the short title. I did note that this will need to be amended in committee stage. It is said that the amendment has to be amended in 2020. Closely says that the act comes in preparation on the day of publication. Closely says an amendment to section 1 of the Import and Export Act 1986 by inserting a new subsection 3. This will provide a mechanism for the government to implement international agreements, conventions, and any other international obligations. I should add that this relates only to imports into and exports from Gibraltar, the processing and collection of customs duties, and related matters. I should add another bit to the House.
Before I put a question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill?
Mr. Speaker, and it wasn't particularly obvious what this was for. It was a very one section bill, and it's planned to be memorandum, really just shows what the expanded memorandum really just repeats was that it was in the clause, but the focus was when it was a conflict. And I just ask the member to clarify if you can. Is this related simply to consequential issues as a result of maybe the withdrawal agreement or Brexit arrangements? Is it related to the MOU specifically? Is it, can you give us a bit more guidance? Because it's been quite generic in this presentation, and the bill and the explanatory memorandum doesn't really assist in any way in helping us to understand. So, on this side of the House, we don't want to place hurdles where there aren't, so perhaps we can just be dealt with other clarification. And if you can clarify, then we will have a good understanding of the objective behind it.
I just need to get there are a number of international conventions, Council of Europe conventions, for example, related to the transport of goods and relating to customs, matters, and customs issues. Some of those conventions have been extended to the water already, but they haven't been given legal legal effect in the water. This was one of the things the European Union didn't require to do that. But now, as we leave the European Union, we need to ring-fence and protect certain areas and the manner in which the goods arrive at the water. The mechanism that we have to do that are the international conventions, which happening with the United States. So that is, as we are going to the more detailed data, I think it's an opportunity to give us probably, but that is a bit of an example of an international legal framework relating to the transportation of goods, moving the goods across the border and customs surface people, which we would like to implement in the as we've talked about it last in the European Union. To be able to let the European Union say even if it's necessary to do it. I'm going to the Minister for Transportation. Oh, no, it's green. Is that what's going on? Sorry, my arm is.
I now put the question, which is that the Bill Horn Act to amend the Imports and Exports Act 1986 be read a second time. Those in favor? Those against? Carried.
The Imports and Exports Amendment Act 2019. Notice that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today?
A bill prior to amend the Freedom of Information Act 2018. The Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister. I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Freedom of Information Act 2018 to be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Freedom of Information Act 2018 be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Freedom of Information Amendment Act 2019. I have the honour to move us that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, this House unanimously approved the Freedom of Information Act 2018. I've said at the time that other countries which have adopted this legislation, there is a gap of several years between its approval and its commencement. The reason for this is that the public administration needs to prepare for the implementation of the Freedom of Information regime. Mr. Speaker, the guidance has been shown by the Information Commissioner that there are now three government departments ready to be listed in the schedule. However, before that happens, the government has been advised that there is a need to amend the Act and to bring it up to date in a number of important areas. This bill, as the financial memorandum next year, amends references to the Data Protection Act 2004. And include references to the General Data Protection Regulation, which is Regulation EU 2016-679. It also identical to potential amendments made by the Act. I also presented now two minor amendments which I will be moving in committee stage. The first includes one of the bill where again 2019 has been changed to 2020. The second is to remove the inverted commas in the footstop at the end of clause 3-6. Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House.
I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak in general principles and merits of the bill? I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Freedom of Information Act 2018 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Freedom of Information Amendment Act 2019. effective notice for the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken to them if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken to them?
Committee stage and third reading, the honourable chief minister.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the House would resolve its legislative committee to consider the following bills called by call. The Import and Export Amendment Bill 2019 and the Freedom of Information Amendment Act 2019.
To amend the Import and Export Act 1986. Clause 1. Mr. Chairman, this is the amendment of the date, 2019 to 2020.
Clause 1 is amended and pardon bill.
Clauses 2 and 3.
Clauses 2 and 3 and pardon bill.
Round table.
Stands part of the bill.
A bill for an act to amend the Freedom of Information Act 2018. Clause 1. Mr. Chairman, again, amending the year from 2019 to 2020.
Clause 1 of amended stands part of the bill.
Clause 2.
Clause 2 stands part of the bill.
Clause 3. The effort element at clause 3.6b. Removing the inverted commas after the full stop at the end of the clause.
Clause 3 as amended stands part of the bill.
The long title.
The long title stands part of the bill. The Import and Export Amendment Bill as amended and the Freedom of Information Amendment Bill 2019 as amended be read a third time and passed. Those in favour of the Import and Export Amendment Bill 2019, those against, carried. Those in favour of the Freedom of Information Amendment Bill 2019, those against,
Mr. Speaker, this is the last opportunity that we will have to meet before the referendum of the 19th of March. The House has agreed, the government has agreed, that the meeting of the House next month, should be the week after the referendum, not the week of the referendum, which is the third week of the month. And so I now move that the House to adjourn in a deal, knowing that next month we will be meeting the fourth week rather than the third week of the month.
I now propose a question, which is that this House is now adjourned in a deal. I now put the question, which is that this House is now adjourned in a deal. Those in favour, those against, are. This House is now adjourned in a deal.